Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
With you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM in your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. With our focus being mostly, but not all, biological psychology, evolutionary psychology, the merger of psychology and the body in many different ways, and the spirit, of course. Evolutionary psychology is the study of the human mind, and in this study there are principles and results that are drawn from biology, evolutionary biology, anthropology, and neuroscience. These they integrate, you know, they put them all together and they say, okay, the past and the present and the chemistry of the past and the present will help us map human nature. And by human nature, we mean the modern architecture of the human brain and mind. So human nature is the way people are. But it doesn't necessarily mean that people are aware of the way they are, because according to evolution, a lot of this stuff was meant to be instinctual. So you're not very conscious of many of the reactions you have.
And it's fascinating to find out how things developed, how things happened. It's fascinating to think back about what people had to go through and what were the challenges that they had to face that led them to develop, for instance, the nervous system and the immune system the way they are.
In fact, we could take a look at one specific thing, and we're going to look at it today because I found, I thought yesterday when I presented to you information about danger and about people's attraction to danger and the need for danger and how danger served as part of the evolutionary drive, how danger works at making the development of the brain by using the chemicals of dopamine and so on and so forth, I thought it would be important to look at fear again. Take another look at fear, because there's more fear out there than you think, my friends. Almost all erratic human behavior is based on fear. Get that? Almost everything that strikes you, that confuses you, that boggles your mind is based on fear. Almost every human behavior that seems harmful is based on fear. So we're going to look at that today.
So true, Armand. And often people, if you ask the question, are you aware of what it is that you're afraid of, often they would say no. I'm not sure.
In fact, if you ask people what they feel, they would rarely say fear.
Right, right.
You know, if you say to somebody who's expressing outrage, how do you feel? They'll say angry, but they won't say fear.
Mm-hmm.
But we know the fear is under there. Let's take one of the ancestrally recurrent situations that would have been the beginning of fear. Let's look at the beginning of fear. And what is that one place, the one place that fear was going to become very important? And that's the recurrent situation of being alone at night in a situation in which there's a possible, all of your instincts say, or you're being aware of, a possible predator, either a human or an animal predator. So just imagine you're some kind of old being, or prehistoric being, not too prehistoric, but, you know, one of those from a few million years ago.
One that I would call a hominid, Armand?
Hominid.
What's my favorite?
I don't know the song, but hominid. Hey, speak about hominids. This idea, hominid, right?
Mm-hmm.
This idea, sleeping. An emotion,
right?
You've got to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But in our old days, everybody was eating and being eaten. Like in the jungle, everybody eats or is eaten. Like in the sea, everybody's eating or eaten. In the sky, all the birds eating or getting eaten.
Being eaten, right.
Right? Your eggs getting eaten, being eaten, you know, or growing up and they're going to go eat something. So this whole thing that happens in nature was happening there with the hominids. And there they are sitting around and they're saying, oh, somebody may come and get me. Either it's going to be a bigger hominid who's going to crack me over the head and either eat me or kill me or take my stuff. Or it could be an animal who wants to have me for lunch. I'd like to have you for dinner. Okay, but so the fear becomes a certain sense that you get, the sense of being stalked. Now, what's important about this is by the end of the program today, we are going to link the fear of being stalked by another animal to most neurotic behaviors of today. It's amazing.
It is. And, you know, as uncomfortable as fear can be, but if you think about the fact that a person needs to have a program for sleeping in their nervous system that gets activated when there's the need for rest. And the person also needs to have a program for self-defense in the case, as you're mentioning, in the case, if the case would arise that there's a predator that shows up. Fear allows the body to get into the right mode, into the right action in a very, very short amount of time. And without fear, that would be impossible.
Let's go over some of the steps, which include what you're saying, Roberta, about the self-defense. So I want to present to you a series of steps that happen with everyone when they feel fear. Everyone, this is their shifts. Number one, the first thing when you feel fear is that there's a shift in perception and attention. Now, in other words, you may hear what will happen is if you think there's a danger somewhere, or if somebody's talking to you and they're angry with you, or if you're afraid to walk down a street, you may suddenly hear with greater clarity because your hearing will increase. It'll become sharper. Things that you would not attend to normally, like creaks or rustling, you'll begin to hear. Your smell might actually improve. Your vision certainly becomes focused to spot the danger. Is the rustling or the creaking that you're hearing somebody moving stealthily through the bushes to come and get you? Signal detection is what it's called. Your threshold for signal detection lifts. Every evidence is required before you respond as if there were a threat, but the more positives, right, the more it will add to this kind of regular alarms. So you have to be careful for false alarms because your nervous system can't take getting too frightened too often. So you look for a series of things to go off before you feel the real alarm. So let's say you're walking down the street and there's somebody lurking in a corner. Alarm number one may go off, but then you see that person lurking in the corner and they disappear. Alarm number two, you can't keep an eye on them. You're going down the street further and another person appears behind you. Alarm number three goes off. Right? And then you walk further down the street and five or six people gather around you and alarm number seven and eight and nine go off. And then you get your backup ready to fight and they come over and they say, can I have your autograph? You know, and meanwhile, all you've done. In fact, I had that happen to me in Haiti once. I remember I was driving a car and the car got a flat. And it was the middle of the night. I was coming back from the beach and I was very young. I was like 20 years old. And I was stuck with a flat on the road. And a truck pulls up and these guys get out with machetes. And I'm going, oh, this is the end of me. They're going to chop me up, right? Mm. And they get over and I'm so frightened. And they come over and they say, what's the matter? And I say, here's my car. And they say, oh, we'll change it for you. And they collectively pick up the car and change the tire and send me on my way. But believe me, there was enough perspiration there to float the car. I was so worried about it. So signal detection is important. Let's think about being burglarized at home. You get burglarized at home, happens to a lot of people. Every time you go home, it requires less signals to put you on end. Number one, you know, every time you walk in your house, every time you turn your key, every time you hit the latch after you've been burglarized, you're nervous. Number two, goals and motivational weighings change. In other words, what's important to you? What's your goal in life? When you're frightened, there's only one thing that counts, safety. When you're frightened and you're behaving in a frightened way, it's safety. Let's say you're talking to somebody you love, and suddenly you're talking in an irritable way. and you're sounding like nasty. And they hear you as nasty, so they respond to you with nastiness. And the two of you go back and forth with nastiness. You know what's going on in both of your minds? How do I get safe? How do I get safe? I'm in danger. The danger's increasing. The danger's increasing. The danger's increasing. And by spitting back at the other person, you're increasing the danger. And the whole concern is, how do I get safe? How can I get away from this danger? Nobody wants this danger to build. One would imagine whenever couples start screaming at each other that they would just hug each other instead and remind each other that they're friends. But they don't. And so it gets up there. See, here's another example. People at your job are being laid off. Now, you're just doing your job. Going to work becomes very different because anytime you receive a notice, people at your job, they're being laid off. This happens in a lot of companies. Anytime you receive a notice of a meeting from a manager or a supervisor, a part of you gets nervous. Uh-oh, piece of mail from my boss. You get defensive. Whereas before the layoffs, you may have more felt more casual about the meeting. Maybe I'm getting invited to a party. Now every letter is scary. And so you get a little punchy. And so you go into that change of opening a letter or seeing a letter and saying, am I safe? Am I safe? And then after a while, you start getting punchy. Imagine following 9/11. Everything went around safety. Everything was happening around safety. Everything was about how do we get safe. Remember duct tape? Remember duct tape and what was the other thing that you had to buy?
I only remember duct tape.
Duct tape galore. Duct tape and people buying homes in farmlands that they would have never bought before. There are more people who own property now in little parts of the world because they thought they were going to get away from. I knew people who moved from New York to Mexico because they thought Mexico would never get bombed.
You know, Armand, as you're describing fear, you seem to describe most of it as being in our own mind and imagination rather than related to something that is really happening. And I think that you're saying something really true, that once the sympathetic system is activated to a certain level in response to fear, it's difficult to turn it off because it's almost as if the body says, well, if I am in this state of alarm, I probably should stay vigilant because something might happen to me, and then you go off in your imagination. What I'm saying is that there is also biochemistry of fear that can get activated and stay activated even when there is no need for it to be activated.
Certainly. And when it does, Roberta, one of the things that you're right about is once the biochemistry of fear, which has to do with, you know, raising the, getting your blood to go to your strong muscles, you know, so that you could be there for fights, secreting a blood clotting mechanism in the body, the releasing sugar so you could have that for battle, you know. When all of these things go on, which we'll go into a little later, once they go on, the next thing you look for is where's the danger? So the first thing is, how do I get safety? And the second thing is, where's the danger? We're always looking for where's the danger. So doesn't it make sense if you feel nervous from drinking too much coffee, and if you say, let's say you drink 3 cups of coffee real fast and you get very nervous, your body is going off on some kind of a fear reaction. That's what all that trembling is. And now you feel this kind of trembling and fear. And if somebody would have walked by and tapped you on the shoulder, you might jump because you're saying to yourself, where's the danger? Oh, there it is. Anything tapping me, anything surprising me.
Right.
This is Armand DeMille. We're talking about fear. And we're going to teach you some stuff about fear that you've never heard before, but it's going to be really amazing. Because one of the things that you have to learn about is you learn about defensiveness. See, most people don't even know that they have a fear reaction. They don't know it. Yet they will suddenly have all the signs, but the words they say don't reflect fear directly. Did you ever try to bring something to someone's attention and they react defensively? Sometimes all you have to do is say, hey, I noticed you left the light on last night. But the reaction is a wave of defensive explanation. Well, you know, I had to leave the light on because the light was, you know, I didn't leave the light on. I think the cleaning lady left the light on, and, you know, and it's just a... But all you're saying is, I noticed this happened, but the defensiveness is so strong. And that, I don't know if any of you remember being a teenager, I do, or being a kid. It's as if to say, is there a reason? The reaction is a wave of this defensive explanation, like a kids do with their fathers. You know, when your father comes over to you and you're a kid, if you've got a punitive father and he says, did you, whatever it is, did you go out where I told you not to go out? Did you go to that place that I told you not to go? Well, the reaction is going to be this classic defensive reaction.
So it is then what I was saying is that if you get this chemistry activated, then you almost look for reasons to be afraid of something because you have to justify the way you feel.
Yep.
Right?
Yes, and this justification can get really crazy because...
Right, you can end up imagining things.
Let's say your teacher says to you, well, no, you could also wind up creating things.
Right, attracting things, looking for things.
No, but I'm going to go with the creating for a moment. Your teacher says to you, you thought maybe you'd get away without being noticed in school that day, and your teacher says, well, where's your homework? And you say, you know, and you start, and this thing happens in your mouth, and it starts to ramble off these words that you're watching appear as they come out of your mouth. Well, you see, I did do my homework, and I went home and I did my homework, and as I was doing the homework, I had this lightning bolt struck my house, and then it struck my house, and the dog got scared. But then the dog got hungry, and it saw my homework, and it thought my homework was its food, and it was eating the homework, and before I could get there, the dog ate my homework. And you have the story that came out of your mouth, this defensive kind of creation. And if children could do it, don't think adults don't do that. They do it. They create the reason out of some kind of a reaction because, like Roberta says, the chemistry is going off and then it produces it. So we're talking about organic fear reactions. As well as organic fear reactions, the way nature gave us this equipment is to avoid the predator. That's what we're trying to do. There are shifts in perception and attention, remember that. Safety becomes the highest priority. Now, other goals get deactivated. If you're frightened, excuse me, other goals get deactivated, such as if you're hungry and you get frightened, you're no longer hungry. If you're trying to charm a mate, a potential mate, and you get scared, you lose that intention. You lose your intention. If you were practicing a new skill or you're trying to learn something, it no longer becomes your attention. Your planning focus narrows to the present. You don't think about yesterday and tomorrow as much. They disappear. You're just, how am I going to get by? How am I going to get safe?
You know what else happens, Armand? Your immune system stops protecting you. Because
doesn't need to, because you're only for here now.
Well, and also because at the cellular level, when this fear is activated, the chemistry is such that the cells are saying, we have to invest this energy that we are producing into protecting the body, not doing the things that we would normally do. So when the emotion is active more often, let's say, or more intensely than it needs to be, the immune system goes down because at first it's also activated too much, meaning that you can be hyper-protected. But then eventually you kind of run out of juice and it becomes a suppressed immunity in the long run. So fear emotions suppress immunity in the long run when they are in this way that we are describing, when it becomes a stressful way of living, when we're always afraid of something, that's when the immune system goes down.
This is Armand Dumoulin with Roberta Mariotti. We're talking about fear reactions that you may not notice, fear that comes from your history. Remember, it's looking for safety. one of the things that happens to a person when they get frightened, and now I want to use the word nervous for a moment. You know, people say, how do you feel? I feel nervous. It means frightened. When somebody comes to me with their child and they say, I want you to look at my child, he's a little nervous, it means he's a little frightened. Right? A person says, how are you feeling? Nervous. You know, it's frightened. So if you were to look, you could ask that person, what are you afraid of? And they won't know it. But the fear reaction, the nervousness tells you fear is present. So what happens when you get frightened, and we're talking about some of the things that happen, hunger, thirst, and pain are all suppressed. Information gathering is redirected. Now, of course, if you're frightened, one of the things you're doing, if there's a predator around, is you've got a safety again. Remember, first thought, where is my baby? You know, that's if you're an animal who's, if you're a hominid and you're part of you're a woman who's out there, first thought is, where is my baby? Imagine that. I mean, you get frightened. Mother's response, where is my baby? It's automatic. It's mm-hmm. built into you.
Right.
Then after that, where are others who could protect me? Now, this is very interesting because this is another thought that comes into your mind. Walking down the street, I'm alone. There's nobody around who could protect me. But natural response is to look for anything you have to protect. Look for others to protect you. Then you look for a place where you can go you look for a place where you can go and hide. You look for shelter, potential shelter. Now, this is even if you're in a restaurant and somebody's yelling at you, you wonder, how am I going to get out of here? How am I going to get out of the situation? How might somebody protect me in this situation? How bad is this going to get? Your reaction is so severe. And you look for a safety place, a hiding place. You wonder, maybe you should go to the bathroom for the moment. Did you ever get the need when you're sitting with somebody and you just don't feel good about being with them and you go to the bathroom? What's the bathroom stall about? It's a safety place. It's a hiding place. It's a place where you hope you could calm down. You look to see your fear disappear, you know. And it's kind of funny what happens when somebody is frightened. There is a need for their bowels and their bladder to empty. Because in battle, you know, very often, you want to have the lightest amount of weight that you're carrying around for the fight. Right. So the need to go to the bathroom becomes this kind of search for safety. All this is going on when you're having a heated conversation with somebody you love. I know somebody recently who was fasting. And fasting, you know, is a very funny thing because if you're fasting for a couple of days, your body interprets it as starvation.
Sure. Sure it does.
Now you're in starvation mode. And if you're in starvation mode, it automatically engenders fear. Why am I starving? You know, is there danger here? Will I die? And so he had this kind of tension that he was carrying with him. And somebody comes along and carries on a conversation with him, and they're carrying on a conversation, and he's being very sharp and very angry, and not knowing why he's being so restless. But the fasting was kind of making this happen, putting him on edge, putting him in a frightened place. Another thing that happens between people is your memory processes are directed to new retrieval passes. You recall the previous time that you were in the same danger and how it was handled. Very often, memory will send you back to childhood when somebody else was yelling at you, like your mother and father, and what the consequences were. So the memory process goes to work to recall similar situations.
Sure, because fear is such a survival-based emotion that if you learn to be afraid in a certain situation, then the trigger for that same situation would bring back that fear to protect you. As you were saying before, Armand, it's always about safety.
It's always about safety. For example, for a while there after 9/11, every time I heard a low-flying plane over Manhattan, you know, I was punchy. I could feel that kind of thing going on. Mm. And I would be scoping. I would be saying, okay, what if that did explode, where would I be going for the first couple of days? Communication process change. This is step number 9 in the fear reaction. Now, this is a very fascinating thing. If you're unconsciously frightened and you don't know it, and you're carrying on a conversation with somebody, your tone or your voice changes. And your voice or your tone, and you wonder, why is my voice or tone changing? What's happening with my voice?
Well, the tension builds up, I guess, from all the chemical changes that are going on, and from the breathing rate that increases, the heart rate that's increasing. You know, I also think that fear is contagious, Armand. That if you're sitting next to someone who's afraid, they actually have they emit an odor that you may not pick up consciously, but you pick it up subconsciously, and it may awaken your fears as well.
So you get theirs and they get yours.
Right.
So what also happens...
Or you get theirs and, you know, and that's it. I'm just saying that you may be walking around not afraid, but if someone else is afraid in your environment, you may resonate with that fear.
Let's get specific.
And get scared yourself.
Let's say your guy's with his lady friend or boyfriend, and the two of them are together, and she's very nervous, and she starts talking in a nervous kind of way. We've kind of established nervousness is fear. Now she's frightened, and I think you're right. What happens is that fear gets to him. It starts to get through, because fear being catching is important for a tribe, for a group. It's important that there's a ripple of fear. It's important that if one gets frightened, the others get frightened.
It's a way to protect the tribe, sure.
So if you get frightened, and I see you're kind of irritable and a little nasty and you're on edge, well, then I get frightened too, unconsciously,
because
I start yelling at you. Mm. See, then I get angry. Anger is one of the reactions. Now, this is another important thing we discovered about fear. It has two potential expressions. It wants to be expressed in one of two ways. It's either going to be external or internal. Your body prepares to either make a sound, and the sound is going to be one of two things, either anger to ward off the enemy, right? So in other words, if you get frightened, you may want to shout at the person who's coming at you to warn them and make them think you're bigger than you are and that you could hurt them. So that's one fear reaction. The other fear reaction is to call out as if to attract people to help you or to attract others to help you. So very often I've been in a restaurant where I see a couple arguing, and they raise their voice and I'm wondering, why are they raising their voice? Usually one of the two people are raising their voice, and really in effect what they may be doing is trying to attract attention to help them in this battle.
Mm-hmm.
So raising your voice or trying to attract somebody to help you is one, or screaming in anger is the other, and the third one is, of course, to play dead, to go quiet. To hope that if you go quiet, you become unnoticeable. And that's like, you know, the one who goes silent when they're frightened. Yeah.
But also some people, when they're afraid, they act like bullies.
They intimidate
people. They attack because they don't want to show that they're afraid, maybe. So they
start attacking.
Well,
that's what anger does, Roberta.
And so I think that... people will react to fear in the way that they're used to reacting based on what they grew up with.
Yes, and I think you're right that all bullies are frightened people.
Yes.
Okay, this is Armand Demille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to bring you some pretty music. Something interesting, something to make this spring day, and a celebration, my friends. In 1973, on this very day, the last soldier left Vietnam to come back to America. Let's see if we could kind of put that in our wishes as well. Armand Demille, Roberta Maria Atti, we'll be back with you in just a little bit. WBAI 99.5 FM. On your dial.
Hi, this is Rupert Holmes, and like me, you're always tuned to WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York. I threw in a little something extra there. So just kind of, I'm not trying to say I've been holding back, but...
There are songs that sound like movies. There are themes that fill the screen. Thank you.
listening to Vivaldi. That's L'estro armonico. Is that how you pronounce that?
Let me see.
Yes,
L'estro armonico.
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 What does armonico mean?
Harmonic.
Oh, harmonic. How nice. Mm-hmm. How nice. And that is opus number 3, concerto number 11 in D minor. You might have all known that. Playing it for the spring. This is Armand DeMille. Somebody sent me a card, a beautiful card. It said, how old would you be if you didn't know how old you are? That's by Satchel Paige. That's an interesting question, don't you think?
Yes, definitely.
It's got a photograph of a nun playing, what do you call that? Boppy ball.
A boppy ball?
You know those sticks with the ball at the end of it? What did you...
I'm not sure what they're called.
I had them when we were kids. They had a little stapled ball.
I don't know what they're called.
On a rubber band. Anyway, how old would you be if you didn't know how old you were? And let's say you lost your age somehow, and somebody said, how old are you? How old are you, Roberta, you know? And what you would come up with as a number is how old you feel.
Hmm.
It's an interesting question, don't
but
you think?
I don't know that you would have a concept of age if you didn't know how old you were. Maybe
yeah, but
you
let's
wouldn't
say you
think
did know and you forgot.
As you wouldn't think of yourself as someone with an age.
But what if you forgot your age?
I guess you would guess.
You forget. Maybe that's a nice thing about, you know, getting older and losing memory. You forget your age, so when people ask you, you can make it up.
My grandmother, she was 92. She thought she was 35.
See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yep.
Hey, this is Armand DeMille. You know, there's another thing. We were talking, if you just tuned in for Vivaldi. This is The Positive Mind on WBAI 99.5 FM. We talk about psychology. On Wednesdays, we usually talk about evolutionary psychology or some biological psychology, some variation there is. They're in, and I have with me my researcher friend and associate, Roberta Maria Atti, who usually does most of the work, and I do most of the presentation, but usually comes up with something or other. Just got back from Italy, didn't you?
Yep.
What are you doing there?
I was doing a lot of things. I was teaching, I was learning, I was visiting, I was shopping, the things you do in Italy.
Anything change in Italy? You didn't say eat.
Well, eat is always implied. Yes, I ate very well. Yes, delightfully. And the weather was fantastic. All the trees were in bloom.
Roberta, when you're in Italy, do you feel less frightened than you do in America?
Less frightened?
Yeah.
It depends on the situation.
You mean it's not across the board in Italy? There are times in Italy that you will feel the same
but
level of...
I think that there's something to be said for Italy being my country of origin, so
yes, that's
feeling,
what I mean.
Feeling like home, and therefore, you know, I think when you feel like you're home, there's less fear than anywhere else. So
I wonder about that. If you were to talk about my home, you wouldn't feel that way.
Mm.
My feeling
I'm
of
not
home
talking
is a place
about the
of
family.
Danger.
I'm not talking
no,
about
No, I'm
the
talking
family.
About the neighborhood, the
talking
situation.
I'm talking about the land. I'm talking about the earth, the ground that gave you a body.
Yeah, no, I understand.
I'm talking about the feeling, the smell of Italy. I mean, when I land in Italy, I can smell it. And
your home.
It's reassuring, yes. So, no, I'm generally not afraid in Italy. But I'm not afraid in New York either. In fact, I remember you mentioned 9/11, that a lot of people after 9/11 were afraid. And I remember distinctly not being afraid and asking myself, what's wrong with me that I'm not afraid? Maybe fear is not something I indulge in.
Well, maybe there's a counterphobia, which is the other side of fear.
Right, right, right.
It's one of the ways that people deal with fear.
Yes.
They become fearless. You know, it's like that's where the whole concept...
Like a challenge.
The whole concept of bravery and the soldiers who get medals are soldiers who felt fear but dealt with their fear by overcoming their fear by going completely on the other side. In fact, losing their mind for a moment.
Sure.
And he charged up that mountain and he shot 54 of those the Bosnians or whatever he was shooting, and then he took the machine gun nest and
there is a way in which a person can take fear on and face it in a way whereby you get bigger than the fear. But I don't think that that's going to change the chemistry of it. I think it changes maybe the perception of it, but not necessarily the chemistry. I think in your body, the fear is still doing what it's doing at the cellular level.
My experience of it is, it's interesting, Roberta, because my experience is that I do. When I get to that, when I've been in danger, I've been in a dangerous situation, the fear kicks in. And then I somehow take this fear and I regard it. I accept it. And what happens is I have this kind of rhythm that I'm riding. It's now like a vibration. And so it's still present, but it's not present as fear. It's present as a different form of energy, sure, but it's definitely there.
But that's what fear is meant to do, Armand. I think that sure fear is meant to make you stronger. It's not meant to weaken you. I think that what we were saying before is that when we experience it more than what the body can adjust to, or more than when the body can deal with, then it can weaken us for longer than what we can deal with, or more intensely than what we can handle. But fear in itself is actually meant to make us stronger, because everything that happens in the body as a result of fear brings blood to the muscles, more air to the lungs, more oxygen to the brain, more strength in the heartbeat. So actually what you're describing is what fear should do. The feeling that we can protect ourselves, or we can fight, or we can do what's appropriate. But I think what we're discussing is when people, unfortunately, because of, unnecessary alarmist propaganda, people experience too much fear for too long. And that's what I was trying to describe before, that what happens is basically a consuming of resources, because fear requires that we use our energy more energy than normal. When we're afraid, we burn more energy, more resources. What happened?
You're there. No, it's just a...
We burn more than when we're not afraid. Did you know that?
Well, yeah, and it's an interesting thing too, Roberta, about fear. Since fear is supposed to strengthen you, which it does, and it does make you stronger for the moment, then what you have is tension. Now, tension is a natural reaction to fear. You tense your muscles. You get ready to fight. You get ready to react. So you're either going to react by running or fighting, fleeing or fighting, but this is a tension reaction. So tension is a natural response to fear. Then tension, if you hold it,
right,
becomes strain. Now, what is strain? What's the difference between tension and strain? Well, tension is when you're holding your muscles tight in a certain kind of way, and there's a certain amount of oxygen that kind of passes through those muscles. When you hold it tight for a long period of time, they lose their oxygen, and you begin to break down the tissue.
Sure.
Breaking down the tissue of tension, holding tension too long, breaks down tissue, and that's what strain is. And that's where strain starts to disable you. And that's what you're saying about
right,
the immune system going.
Well, that's part of it, but there's actually what's been observed is that when we're afraid, our cells behave as if the energy that they produce, that they extract from the food that we eat, should be used to defend, to protect the body. Not to grow, not to repair, not to maintain, not to do anything else but protect. So it's as if people lived in bomb shelters. Well, you can live in a bomb shelter for a day, for a week, but if you live there for 3 years and you never get out because you're afraid of bombs, eventually you run out of water, you run out of food, and you run out of air, and you're always in the dark, and you know, it's like you live the protected life. That's what fear can do.
And there are many people who have fear as their basic modus operandi. There are a lot of people who walk around who are frightened all the time. And they're frightened, and they're usually, you know, especially the Woody Allen type of person that you see. You know, they're kind of thin-framed, nervous. And remember, nervous is frightened. So you get this kind of person that's like, you know, a deer that's walking through the world.
Jump.
And they have it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the ones who have all of the attacks, and they have the strokes, and they have the heart attacks.
But I think it's because they can't turn off their sympathetic nervous system.
Yep.
It's been activated too much for too long, and it's still active as if there was a danger in the environment, and it can't turn off. These are the people who suffer from insomnia, from
sure.
indigestion, from ulcers, from anxiety, from depression,
reflux.
From reflux, from all kinds of things. And it's really a hyperactivity of the sympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system. By the way, the sympathetic nervous system is the one that makes us active and alert and jumpy and strong. The parasympathetic nervous system is the one that lets us relax and sleep. And when people say, I can't relax, I can't seem to let go of the tension that I have in my muscles and in my body, that could be accumulated fear.
Well, you see, the same thing begins to happen. Of course, it's natural, if you're frightened, to look for danger, and your mind starts going, and your mind starts searching for danger. So once you get into a mental thing where you can't shut your mind off, then you've got this kind of loop that started.
Right.
Your mind is activated. It produces fear thoughts. Your body has fear reactions. Your mind has more fear thoughts. In fact, there's a very interesting fact about what happens during fear. They call it specialized inference systems. The specialized inference systems are not just your natural fear reaction, but you start looking for inferences that give you a help in determining what the danger, true danger is. And this is where I think paranoia has grown out of. The inference systems is you automatically infer, is there true danger and can I tell? For example, if somebody's yelling at you, you look at their hands. If their hands are hiding something, you have a suggestion that you may get hit with something. If their hands are moving, you get a suggestion you may be. So you infer from someone's hands what's happening when they're yelling at you, and you determine what the danger is. If a lion who was in the jungle, or if somebody were an animal who's afraid of a lion, you know what they would look for? They would look at the lion to try to see, is there that look in the lion's eye?
Yeah, the lions behave a certain way when
they
have
a look when they're about to hunt.
Mm-hmm. But you know,
zebras and wildebeests have made this idea. They get this thing called ungulation, which is they determine whether or not the lion is hungry.
And humans do that too. I mean, we're
That's
always
right.
scanning one another for signs of danger and for signs of who to trust and who's a friend and who is not. I think that that's inevitable, but I also think that if a person has the kind of sympathetic activation that doesn't quit, meaning that they're always in a state of alarm, then, as you were saying a while ago, Armand, someone may wave a pencil in front of them, which means nothing, and it's not a threatening, sign of threat, but the person is in a state of fear or already. So they may, the inference, is that how you pronounce it? Inference there may occur because the person is already afraid on the cellular level, even if no one in their environment is dangerous, or if there's nothing going on that explains it. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. Let me ask you, do you think, since nervousness and this kind of condition is a sign, whenever I see nervous, I see fear, do you think that hormonal changes that take place are fear reactions? Do you think, like, if a would trigger a fear reaction? Do you think PMS, for example, would lead to a fear reaction? Would we say that PMS is fear?
Well,
premenstrual syndrome is a fear reaction. It would make a lot of sense.
There certainly is a lot of fear in it, and yes, I guess you could say that.
Is it anything but fear if you think about it? You know what I mean? If you think of that kind
I'm
of
thinking about it,
because you get all of the emotionality, all the stuff that comes with
it. Yeah, it could be. It could be, and it could be that women who suffer from it have some kind of problem like what we've been describing, meaning that they see when the tension accumulates in the muscles, as you were saying a while ago, Armand, as a result of the changes that go on when we're afraid, if the tension is not released through movement, the body may freeze in a way, in a sense, in a state of fear, because the muscles are frozen in a state of fear. So PMS could be a state of withheld energy that has not been released and is experienced as, you know, anxiety, depression, irritability, etc. But maybe it's just the tension in the muscles that is not being let go of.
I think there's one thing that seems to come out of all of this, Roberta, you know, out of this study. I mean, the one thing that I got, the salient point, was that if a person is acting in an odd way, say to yourself, they're frightened. Just say it to yourself. Maybe you're not right, but say the person is frightened. And when you recognize that this person who you're fighting with, who you're having an argument with, is frightened, It's different. It's different if you perceive them as frightened than if you perceive them as attacking. Because if they're attacking, then you get frightened. But if you perceive them as frightened, it more engenders a feeling to be kind, to be decent. You know, so if a child is screaming at me and yelling and saying, "You're the worst father, Diamond, you know, you're a rotten man," and they're yelling at me and I see fear, I sit next to them calmly. I talk to them. I'll wait for them, you know? I don't need them to be nice. I respond to the fear differently than if I were to take the attack as personal and say, this is a personal attack on me, I have to defend myself. If I'm walking down the street, or if I have a friend or an employee who gets really upset and they're overreacting and you could see a big reaction, I could say to myself, this is fear. And I'm looking at fear. And since I'm looking at fear, I don't have to react to it as if that person means to hurt me. It's just that they're afraid that I'm going to hurt them.
Mm-hmm. I think
that would bring us to a much kinder place.
I think that that's the contagion that I was trying to describe a while ago, that sometimes we can be affected by a person's fear and react from the same fear, whereas if we recognize what it is, that the person may need some reassuring body language and speech and behavior from us, that maybe it would make things easier for them and for us. I completely agree with you.
Yes, I would like to see people seriously consider somebody you love who you feel angry with, and consider that they're frightened.
Mm-hmm.
And today, approach people who are nervous or people who are irritable as if they're frightened, and just see how that changes your approach.
Good idea.
You know, especially today, like I said, it not symbolic to you, but to me, because it's the anniversary of the withdrawal from Vietnam, it has meaning to me.
Mm.
it has meaning to me. So today is a kind of an unusual peace day. Maybe, maybe we could all do something about it by being a part of spring and some peace. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. My special thanks to Roberta Maria Atti. Thank you, Roberta, coming directly from the airport, lugging your bags to get here.
Thank you.
You are so dedicated to...
It's always nice to be here.
How do they get to your website?
CreativeHealthSolutions.org.
With an S.
With an S.
And this is Armand DeMille. You can go to thepositivemind.com. From there, you can get archives of today's program or any program we've done in the past, or you can go to the archives of WBAI.org. I will be back with you tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Special thanks to all of you, and a email at armand@brainlink.com. Back with you tomorrow, my friends.
On Saturday, April 1st at 12 noon, join the Black Men's Movement Unity March at Rockaway and Livonia Avenues in Brooklyn. The Black Men's Movement is calling for 500 brothers in black to take back the hood, to put the guns down, and to rename Linden Park in honor of the late Ababadika Sonny Carson. Speakers include Councilman Al Vann, ex-political prisoner Sharsha Brown, Stan Kennard, Ali Lamont, Coltrane Chimurenga, and Councilman Charles Barron. That's Saturday, April 1st, 12 noon at Rockaway and Livonia Avenues in Brooklyn. For more information, call 718-398-1766. That's 718-398-1766. Take back the hood.
Need to escalate.